morning. We have with us this morning students from Deerfield High School. Would they please stand? Deerfield High School. Thank you for coming. You may be seated. And we also have students from Sun Prairie High School. Would they stand, please? Thank you for coming also. You may be seated. The students are here with us on a program that is sponsored by this court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. We invite students from all over the state, generally high school students, to come and participate with the court and you all in an oral argument. And if they accept the invitation, they're sent the briefs of the case we're about to hear, and they may engage in outside activities relating to this case. In addition to hearing the case and examining the briefs, these students will participate with a justice of this court after the second oral argument during the lunch hour. The discussion will be about the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues involved in this case. Everyone, you don't have to be a student, can participate in that discussion with the justice. You're all welcome to attend. Now, the marshal has a summary of this case, so if anyone needs this summary to better listen to the arguments, if you'd raise your hand, she will give you a summary of the case. All right. We've met you. Let me introduce the court to you all. On my far left is Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Justice Patience Rogensack. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and to her right is Justice David Prosser. And on the far right is Justice Lewis Butler. With those introductions made, I will now call the first case, which is 05AP1527, Berner Cheese Corporation versus Lyle A. Crew. Arguing on behalf of the Berner Cheese Corporation is Eugene Schiltz, who will be introduced by Christina Westerberg, a Wisconsin attorney. Ms. Westerberg.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Krista Westerberg with Garvey, McNeil, and McGillivray here in Madison. With me is Eugene Schiltz and Sean Crotty from Robert F. Coleman and Associates in Chicago, Illinois, and they are admitted pro hac vice. Mr. Schiltz will be doing the argument for petitioners today.
Mr. Schiltz is not a member of the State Bar of Wisconsin, is that correct? And you are a member in good standing of another state. If you'd stand in front of the microphone, please.
I am in Illinois, Your Honor.
Fine. So you are seeking admission for this case only, for this proceeding today.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Pro hac vice.
That's correct.
Right. And you're the attorney on the briefs?
Yes, ma'am.
Or your firm is?
My firm is, yes, and with, of course, substantial
good
assistance.
Well, welcome to Wisconsin.
Thank you very much. It's very nice to be here where they have a football team that wins games.
You know how to win their hearts.
That's right. Go Pack.
We're here today to talk about what the restatement calls the law of lawyering. And I think that that's an apt description of the subject matter that we're going to talk about today. And of course, in any case, there are some individual issues that we're going to discuss, and I'll get to those in a minute. But I always think that it's helpful, before you start examining individual trees, to take a brief look at the forest and make sure we all see the forest that these trees are all standing in. And so when we think about lawyers and their role in the legal system, We realize that in this area, as in many other areas, the law is somewhat layered, and so the lawyer's responsibilities come in different layers. One layer is, of course, that we have the rules of professional conduct, which govern everything that lawyers do and which lawyers are subject to, and which are really a regulatory scheme within the province of this court to enforce the discipline of lawyers in the state. Sort of parallel to that is, of course, the civil liability system, which is another vehicle for addressing questions of the responsibility of lawyers. And today's case focuses not on that first layer, the regulatory system, but on the civil liability issues and the questions of when and to what extent lawyers should have civil liability for the acts that they perform in their capacity as lawyers. And, of course, the two tracks follow relatively similar paths, not precisely the same. They have different purposes and different functions, but they generally run in the same direction. And when we move our focus to the civil liability system, we see sort of the same layering effect, and that's really what's at the heart of today's case. Because, of course, the principal vehicle for lawyer misconduct cases has always been what we call a legal malpractice case, what the public understands is a straightforward legal malpractice, negligence-based legal misconduct case. And the vast majority, probably, of the claims that are made in civil court against lawyers are standard negligence-based professional malpractice cases. What we're here to talk about today is whether there should be a second layer to that regime where lawyers should also be responsible for a cause of action that we generally refer to as breach of fiduciary duty. And if so, what should be the basic rules, the basic guidelines that should govern in Wisconsin the way lawyers should be held responsible for what we would call breaches of fiduciary duty? Now, there's no question, of course, lawyers are fiduciaries, and we all understand what that is. And the nature of those fiduciary duties is something that, of course, courts and commentators have spent a lot of time discussing and analyzing. This court, in the Zastrow case last year, of course, had an extended discussion of fiduciary duties and the nature. In the context of lawyers, we have the benefit now of the restatement, which does a really nice job of collecting and summarizing, as the restatement tends to, the law in this country on that issue. And Section 16 of the restatement is a nice starting point because it lays out the basic fiduciary duties that lawyers have and lists in Section 16 all of the various fiduciary duties. Now, in some cases, you can get into a debate about what fiduciary duty we're talking about or what's the nature of this fiduciary duty. In this case, we're talking about something that is really pretty much dead center, always been understood to be part of the fiduciary duties, not just of lawyers, but of any fiduciary, which is really the duty of loyalty and the duty to avoid conflicts of interest. And in essence, the duty not to put your own interests ahead of those of your client. That's really, at the end of the day, what this appeal is about, is what should be the rules when a client comes into court and says, my lawyer has put his interests ahead of mine, and my lawyer has breached his duty to be loyal to me.
I have a question. Who's your lawyer? Who was Berner's lawyer?
Well, Berner had a number of lawyers in this proceeding.
And this is against Krug, right?
Right. Mr. Krug.
So when was Mr. Krug his lawyer?
Mr. Krug had been the company's lawyer for probably 20 years. He was the first person they talked to When this problem with the Steinmans first came up, and of course it's a small world kind of thing that this court dealt with the Steinmans and their situation not too long ago, but when the problem first arose...
It has nothing to do with this case.
No,
okay.
nothing at all, right. Other than the coincidence. But in any event, when the issue arose, the Knievels understandably went to Mr. Krug and said, we need your help. It was then Mr. Krug who brought in all of the other attorneys who ultimately played a role in this proceeding, most notably the Brennan Steil firm that he brought in because he knew there was likely to be litigation in Wisconsin, and he and one of the Brennan Steil attorneys went back away, so he brought that firm in. There was a Chicago attorney named Jim Muskell.
Did Krug represent him in this settlement? Isn't that what we're fighting about?
Did Krug represent them? Krug represented them in everything.
All the time.
He never stopped
being a lawyer.
He never stopped being their lawyer. He was giving them advice on everything from beginning
to end.
That's
your position. Okay.
Absolutely. And certainly with respect to the settlement. So the first question that we have to address, and we frame it in the brief, is in this situation when a client comes into court and says, my lawyer has breached his fiduciary duty, has put his interests ahead of mine, and we ask, well, how did he do that? And our allegation is this is a case, in essence, where the lawyer and the client were both sued. At the time the case settled, the judge had allowed Mr. Krug to be named as a defendant. He was, in fact, a defendant in the case at the time. And so this is a case where the lawyer and the client were both sued together. And in essence, that was resolved by having Berner, the client, pay to get everybody out of the case.
Counsel, what proof is there in the record of what part, if any, of the settlement was attributable to letting Attorney Krug go?
Right. That question goes right to the heart of the issues in this case, and there are really two answers to that, Justice Rogenczak. First is, of course, our position is that that is, in fact, the lawyer's burden. It is not our burden to say what...
That's a separate question.
I understand.
What's in the record.
But then the second question is, at the time the lawsuit was filed, Mr. Krug was advising the client that they were going to win money in this case. And the record indicates that very early after the suit was filed, in fact, Berner wanted to try and settle by demanding $300,000 from the Steinmans to settle. And Mr. Krug said to them, that's...
Right. I understand all of that. I'm looking at the settlement of $1.3 million or whatever it was, and I want to know what part of that was due to letting Attorney Krug go, and what proof is there of that in the record?
Well,
that's my concern.
Well, and that's what I'm trying. I'm trying, maybe not as articulately as I could, to answer the question. But I think the answer is that it was Krug's position right up until the end, really, right up until March, that Berner was going to win money in this case, and it wasn't until he was sued that, in fact, the advice went 180 degrees the other way and said, no, you're not going to win. You're going to lose. In fact, you ought to pay. And they ended up paying $1.35 million. So our position would be we start from the premise, and if the jury had been permitted to consider this claim and been instructed that the burden was theirs, we start from the premise that there was evidence the jury could say that entire $1.35 million was the responsibility of Mr. Krug. Because it wasn't until he was sued that there was any argument that Berner should pay. And then it's his burden at that point to knock that number down and persuade the jury that the number should have been lower because some of that was attributable to Berner's own fault.
Is there anything in the record that shows what the $1.3 million is tied to? What losses it was tied to on behalf of?
Well, there were two lawsuits going at the time. There was a federal lawsuit and a state lawsuit, and there were claims both ways by Berner against the Steinmans and by the Steinmans against Berner. And there were a multitude of claims, mostly arising out of this, what we call the raid and all the related activities. So the settlement was, in essence, a settlement of that litigation.
Counsel, let me interrupt you for a minute.
Sure.
What concerns me is that, as I understand the facts here, the $1.35 million settlement was actually agreed to by the parties without counsel being present. Isn't that correct?
Well, it's kind of interesting. The way, let me just tell you the way that played out, and the facts are that, that as I said a minute ago, that in the space of a month, we went from Berner's going to collect to Berner's going to pay, and Berner's going to pay $500,000, Berner's going to pay $1 million, the lawyers are pushing Berner, put more money on the table, put more money on the table, put more money on the table, to the point where on the day that the motion to add Krug as a defendant was granted, the lawyers were saying, put $1.5 million on the table, that'll settle the case. The motion is granted. At that point, everybody walked across the street. This is in Elkhorn, to Mr. Blackburn's office, the Steinman's lawyer's office. At that point, Mr. Kniebel, Ed Kniebel, essentially did say that, listen, you guys have pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed us to put more money on the table. Let me talk to the Steinmans and see if I can resolve this for something less than $1.5 million. And he did, at that point, go into a room, just Mr. Kniebel and the Steinmans, and they agreed on the $1.35 million as opposed to the $1.5 million that...
Where was Krug at the time?
I don't believe Mr. Krug was even present at the time. I'm not sure. He certainly, no one was in the room when the actual number was reached other than the Kniebels and Ed Kniebel and the two Steinmans.
Kniebel's the principal, the CEO for
The two owners. It's two brothers, and they both own the company, basically. So one of the two had come up. But that is the case. But, you know, it's our position, in essence, that at that point all Mr. Kniebel was doing was stopping the bleeding. The Kniebels were terrified at this point. I mean, they had gone from, you're going to win this case, you're going to collect $300,000, to all of a sudden they couldn't get money out of their pockets fast enough. The lawyers telling them, you need to come up with more money, you need to come up with more money, you need to come up with more money, we're going to be sued, we are being sued, you need to pay our defense costs, you need to indemnify us, you need to keep coming up with more and more money. And Mr. Kniebel at that point, in essence, said, you know, I got to put a stop to this, and sat down with the Steinmans. And it was actually kind of a humorous note. I'm sure Mr. Konasek will remember it. At Ed Kniebel's deposition, Mr. Konasek asked him what his goal was when he went into that. And he said, I was just trying to get away without paying any more than they were already asking for. But that was basically what happened.
What part of Krug's conduct qualifies as malicious or intentional regards for the rights of the plaintiff?
Well, we would say that the most obvious, that there were four basic pieces of evidence that we would point to where Mr. Krug or his partner Hastings flatly admitted that what they did violated the breach of the duty of loyalty. First, they admitted Mr. Hastings said that Berner had no duty to indemnify Krug, and it was a breach of the duty of loyalty for Mr. Krug to go ahead and seek indemnification from Berner. And then when he learned that Krug had done that, he didn't go to Berner and say, I think that Mr. Krug has breached his duty of loyalty. He said nothing. Then the flip happened. Ultimately, Mr. Hastings got worried enough about the liability of his firm that he went and added his voice to the chorus, trying to pressure Berner. And Mr. Krug admitted that was a breach of the duty of loyalty for Mr. Hastings to do that. And yet he, of course, said nothing to Berner about that. Mr. Krug also admitted that it was a breach of the duty of loyalty for them to pressure Berner to try and settle the case because they didn't want to have to report it to their insurance company because they had reason to believe the insurance company was not going to treat it as a covered claim and they were going to be without insurance. And so Mr. Krug admitted that it was a breach of the duty of loyalty to do that. And then finally, Mr. Hastings admitted that there were certain documents in Mr. Krug's file that, in his words, and he wrote this in his handwritten notes, suggested damning evidence of legal malpractice by Mr. Krug, and also indicated that Mr. Krug had lied in his deposition And Mr. Hastings admitted that it was his duty at that point to go to the client and lay this out and explore with the client the options of how they might handle that, and in particular, were they better off essentially maybe even filing a third-party suit or a cross-claim against Krug. But he didn't do that because he didn't want the Knievels questioning what Mr. Krug had done, and he didn't want the insurance company getting into questions about what advice Mr. Krug had done. So, Justice Ziegler, in my opinion, if in four separate instances lawyers admitting that they breached the duty of loyalty is not enough to create intentional conduct, then I'm not sure what it would take.
Do you think all intentional conduct results in punitive damages?
Oh, no. No, I think that this court has said very clearly that there are a number of other things that you have to look at, and that's why, again, it's the sort of layered thing that we point out in the brief. There are a number of other reasons why we would say they are appropriate in this case, but certainly we would never say that.
Counsel, does the record reflect what the set-offs entail on the issue of punitive damages?
The record does not, and I would have to explain what happened there. There was a motion in limine where this issue came up because Berner had sued some of these other folks. They'd sued their insurance company. They'd sued this Chicago lawyer, and we had received settlements from other defendants. And so the issue came up in the motion in limine, how do we handle that at trial? And essentially the agreement was that we would not tell the jury about the amounts of those settlements, but that Berner would agree that they were entitled to a set-off for the amounts of those settlements on top. We did not resolve the exact amount in the motions in limine because we were still trying to calculate the precise amount of them. This was about 3 weeks before the trial.
So these are set-offs are from third parties that you've sued.
Other suits. What we did is basically Berner put into evidence all of the evidence of the damages, the million three five, all of the attorney's fees and costs attributable with the suit, and then we backed out money that it had already received back from other defendants.
From other defendants, not some kind of set off. For instance, hypothetically, you owe me attorney's fees, or you owe me a fee for something, or. And that
right.
kind of set up. This had to do with settlement monies from other parties.
Yes, except that one small part of it did involve some fees of Mr. Krug because there were some of his fees that were still in dispute that Berner had not paid. And so one small part of it actually did involve a settlement of the open fee dispute with Mr. Krug and giving them a credit for the amount. But the vast majority of it involved settlements with other defendants.
Did you indicate in response to my question that you had an agreement regarding how these settlements would unfold? Is there some kind of an agreement in the record?
It was an agreement. We did the jury instructions conference with Judge Welker on a Saturday morning because we finished the trial at Friday afternoon. Judge Welker wanted to instruct the jury first thing Monday morning to avoid having them have to sit around for an extra day. So we came in on Saturday morning and did the instructions conference. There was no court reporter present. The agreement was reached amongst all the counsel. There was never any dispute about it. Judge Welker was well aware of it. It was a matter that was going to be handled by Judge Welker outside of the jury. And there was never a question about it in any of our minds. And it frankly didn't even become an issue until the appellate court issued a ruling on this Tucker issue.
Mm-hmm.
Quite frankly, it was something that if it had been a problem at the time or any time before the appellate court ruled, we could probably have found a way to reconstruct the record.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it seems like you've got an abyss here on that issue. I'm not sure that it's appropriate to argue that when you get money from a collateral source, which would be that should constitute and translate into a set off that would diminish the ability to get punitive damages.
Mm-hmm.
No, I mean, you get collateral source contributions all the time. But it seems to me that perhaps this agreement or stipulation that you entered into might trump what would be the ordinary application of the law. But I have no knowledge of what that agreement is and whether it should be trumping the ordinary application of the law.
Yeah, I understand the difficulty, and the agreement was relatively simple. Was if we put
out just
Yeah. Oh, okay. Go ahead.
It's not in the record.
Well,
I got a problem.
Pieces of it are in the record.
You can tell me anything that's in the record.
Well, the motions in limine are in the discussion of the motions in limine, and the understanding that this would be handled by way of a set-off that would be done, applied by Judge Welker after the jury entered its verdict, is in the record, and that's all discussed in the motions in limine. The only thing that's really not in the record is the precise amount of the set-off that we ultimately agreed to with counsel, and that Judge Welker was going to apply as sort of a floor to say Berner's not going to collect any money in this case until the damages go above this dollar figure.
Counselor, but that, as far as the jury is concerned, and as far as Judge Welker's decision was concerned, forget what the Court of Appeals said for the moment, that has nothing to do with the stipulation on set-offs, because the judge didn't let the question go to the jury. So he didn't know if you'd get $1 or $0,
correct.
Right?
That's
so
correct.
The trial judge made his decision independent of the stipulation, whatever it was, on how to handle the payments, correct?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you. Just so I'm clear on
yeah.
the table.
Yeah.
So the error was not giving the jury the instruction.
We didn't think there was any error in the way it was handled. It was all agreed to be handled this way. The dilemma was, do you put all of this evidence of these other settlements in and then let the jury try and figure out what to make of them, or do you handle it the way we agreed to handle it, which is treated as a matter that doesn't concern the jury and that the judge would apply after the fact.
Let me see if I have this right. Then on the trial court judge did not give the question of punitive damages to the jury.
He had already taken that off the table.
That's
by
right.
this point.
You appealed that because you thought the trial judge should, based on the testimony and the alleged conduct, the trial court should have given the issue to the jury. There was sufficient evidence to warrant it. You appealed that issue. However, the Court of Appeals dodged that issue and didn't address it at all and instead went with Tucker.
That's exactly what happened.
And okay. So if you should prevail, what does this court do? Send it back for a jury verdict on punitive damages?
Our view is that if, in fact, the court reverses and gives us back our breach of fiduciary duty claim, that in essence solves the problem to begin with. Since the damages on that could clearly go above the amount of the stipulation, that at that point it's not even an issue. If the breach of fiduciary duty claim is going to be retried, the damages will clearly be high enough that they could go above the amount of the set-offs, and therefore there's no reason even to get into the Tucker issue that the appellate court saw.
But wouldn't you be compensated twice, counsel? I mean, you got him for malpractice for $850,000, and it was the same transaction that you're alleging you breached his fiduciary duty and that he got your client to settle for more than you think is appropriate. So, I mean, you know, we often plead in the alternative, but you can't collect double damages
of
just because you plead in the alternative.
No, of course we cannot. But we didn't collect the $850. That was the whole point. And had the jury been instructed, as we thought they should have, on both counts simultaneously, it's entirely possible that they could have done what they did on the legal malpractice, said $850, 40% contributory negligence, but then on the breach of fiduciary duty said a completely different number, no contributory negligence because it's not a defense, and come in with a completely different number, we would not have collected on both counts
well,
at that
how,
point.
How was the proof different on those two different claims?
Well, The breach of fiduciary, I see my time is up, but if I can answer your question.
Sure, thank you.
The breach of fiduciary duty count, it has, of course, many different aspects to it than the negligence count. Much of the evidence is, of course, the same. But the elements of the cause of action would be different. In our view, the burden of proof would be different.
Right, but look at the damages, because that's what's troubling me.
Right.
Are the damages different?
Well, we would say certainly that they are, and part of it is because, for example, on the breach of fiduciary duty claim, what we might be entitled to get back in the way of attorney's fees, the attorney's fees that Mr. Krug charged. The rules are much more harsh, and we explore this in the brief at some length, in terms of disgorgement of attorney's fees are much higher on the breach of fiduciary duty claim than they might have been on the simple negligence claim.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Okay.
It's my understanding from your brief at page 42 that what you are asking is we remand the case to the circuit court for a trial on the merits of the claim of breach of fiduciary duty and the merits of the claim for punitive damages.
Is that correct?
That is correct,
what we are asking.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We have next counsel Daniel F. Conasek. He will be introduced by Wisconsin attorney Michael Van Sicklin. Mr. Van Sicklin.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, as you know, I'm Mike Van Sicklin from the Madison office of Foley & Lardner. It's my pleasure to introduce my co-counsel and friend from Geneva, Illinois, Daniel Conasek of the Conasek & Dillon firm. Being here is hard to then sit down and turn over those duties, but they're in able hands. He is admitted on appeal pro hoc vici. There is an order in the Court of Appeals admitting him. He is a member of the Illinois Bar in good standing.
Thank you. Mr. Conasek, is everything that Mr. Van Sicklin said correct?
It is correct. It is correct, Your Honor.
Well, then you are admitted pro hoc vici for purposes of appearing in this court.
May it please the Court, I want to start out, and it seems like I'm always responding, but I want to start out with a statement by Mr. Schiltz, who I tell you is also a friend, and that firm and I have known each other for quite some time. He told you that the rule that they are here about is the duty to avoid conflicts and a client putting his or her own, or I'm sorry, the attorney putting his or her own interest ahead of the client. And that's what we're here about. Well, it's not. What we're here about is whether or not the burden of proof, as suggested at page 26 in Berner's brief, should be shifted. What we're here about is whether section 126 of the law of lawyering should be applied by this court because it's a business transaction between clients. And if the law of lawyering under section 126 should be applied, should the burden of proof on the conflict of issue have shifted so there was a presumption in this case, according to their brief at page 26, that the $1.5 million paid by Berner was not in fact for Berner, but was indeed for Mr. Krug. And I point that out because throughout the underlying proceeding, in these proceedings, we use words of undue influence. That's a separate issue. That was an issue that is simple negligence. And let me make this point on that. There are instances, and we pointed them out in our brief, where a lawyer messes up a case, and he or she, in order to hide his or her own negligence, may mislead the client or may tell the client to settle the case. Is that a breach of fiduciary duty? Yes, if you believe the facts are true. But does the burden of proof shift in those circumstances? Absolutely not, and that's not what section 126 of the law of lawyering says. That's not what section 1.8 of the rules of professional conduct say. There is only one circumstance where any courts have ever shifted the burden of proof, and that is where an attorney enters into a business transaction with the client. In that circumstance, courts suggest that the deal between the client, the transaction between the client and the attorney, should have a heightened level of scrutiny by the fact finder, and in some circumstances, some courts have applied this burden-shifting presumption. That's the issue. And the issue is whether or not there was a business transaction entered into by virtue of Lyle Krug being added on the release when Berner settled the case with DSI. That's the issue in the case. Was that a business transaction? And if it was, should Judge Welker have submitted to the jury their breach of fiduciary duty claim and shifted the burden of proof? And this case really is in two parts. It is. There is the negligence with regard, and I'm going to call it colloquially today, although I disputed that it should be called that in the underlying case, the raid or the entry onto the DSI property, where all this began.
This is the so-called self-help?
That's correct, Justice, where Mr. Krug, in the April 5th letter of 1999, Defendant's Exhibit 28 set forth the list of options that his client, Berner, could undertake to take care of this problem, former employee, who Berner thought would literally, and the evidence is undisputed on this, destroy their business. And one of the options was, Justice, the self-help. And that's one part of the case. Was that advice negligent, or was it not negligent? And if it was negligent, what were the damages that were caused by that? There has been no suggestion, and it was not even raised, that that is a burden-shifting negligence standard. The question was an ordinary negligence case. Was Mr. Krug negligent in providing that advice? And if he was, were there damages? Now, this is where we get into this area of breach of fiduciary duty. What they alleged and what we heard throughout the trial, and what I heard Mr. Schultz tell you today, is that Krug and Hastings pressured the client to settle so that the firm and Krug would not sustain money damages or liability. That is a separate and distinct allegation. And that's where I think the focus of this appeal is and should be. And I say that because now, when we focus on that part of the case, and this is where Judge Welker was right on, when we focus on that part of the case, we have to ask the fundamental question, is if we believe that this occurred, what were the damages? The only focus then is, did Krug pressure for Berner to pay the $1.35 million. And Justice Ziegler, when you brought this up and you asked the whole question, the seminal question, is if this conduct indeed occurred, what are the damages? What portion of the $1.35 million can Berner say was related to the payment for Krug to get and secure Krug's release? And in this trial, in this record, not one question was asked of any witness, including the people that were in the very room where the settlement occurred. What portion of the $1.35 million is being paid to secure the release of Lyle Krug? And that is what troubled Judge Welker.
What troubles me is Krug was released from liability, wasn't he? By
yes,
whom?
By DSI and the Steinmans.
All right. Not Berner?
No. And, Your Honor, may I respond to that, Justice?
Yes, of course. That's why I asked the question.
If he were released by Berner, we would have a different ball game. You're absolutely right. And that's where, Justice, where they cite in their brief, the section on Mallon and Smith, and they footnoted in their brief about how if you have a waiver where the attorney and the client enter into a waiver, the court in Illinois, that is, there is a separate rule on that, that if you as a lawyer...
We're in Wisconsin. And this was a Wisconsin case. The activities happened here.
I can't say that 100%. I can say some activities occurred here. But even under Wisconsin rules, I believe you have the exact same rule that a an attorney cannot settle a case with a client, which is your question, settle a case with a client without independent counsel representing the client. That is a no-no. But that's not what occurred here. If that occurred here, I imagine I wouldn't be standing here before you today.
Counsel, you're focusing with regard to breach of fiduciary duty on the alleged pressure put on Berner to pay the $1.35 million.
That's correct.
What about the deal or that part of the deal that provided for indemnification of Krug?
Those are two separate issues. Can I address that? Because I think they both need to be addressed. In the record, on this deal of indemnification, Justice, there is one piece of testimony about that. And the testimony in the record is that on March 27th of the year 2000, Lyle Krug met with the Kniebels face-to-face and said to them, I am going to be added. It appears as though I am going to be added as a defendant in this case. And I am not asking for an answer today on this. I am not giving advice on this. I am telling you that that is going to happen and that I am going to ask independent counsel, Mark McCrory, you to go to him, you the Kniebels, to seek that independent counsel on whether or not I, Lyle Krug, should be indemnified. That is the record on that. I agree with you, Judge Justice, and I'm not sure you've said this, but if Mr. Krug said in that March 27, 2000 meeting, you need to indemnify me, that would be a violation, that would be a breach of fiduciary duty.
So isn't it a matter of line drawing? You know, I was just saying yesterday, that's part of what our job is, we draw a line. So if he had said, you better indemnify me or else, woo, that's 100%, that's bad. I want you to indemnify me, 80%. Yeah. Consider indemnifying me, 70%. Consider talking to an attorney to discuss indemnifying me. Where does that fall on the breach of continuum of what would be considered perhaps a transaction, what would be considered perhaps breach of fiduciary duty, whether or not you define it as a duty of loyalty or a duty to put your client above yourself or however you define it. Where does that fall, that individual fact?
Here's where I think, and there is truly a bright line test. And the bright line test is this, is that if in the first instance, clearly, if you say you are going to indemnify me or else, that's a breach of fiduciary duty, and there's nothing in the record to support that occurred. After that, I think if the lawyer discharges his or her duty under Rule 1.8 of the Wisconsin rules and under the law of lawyering that says, I am not going to give you advice on this. This is something I may ask for. Seek independent counsel. Then by law, the lawyer has discharged his or her duty.
Well, but he's still serving as lawyer, isn't he? I mean, he still was the Berner's lawyer at that time. There was an attorney-client relationship during that period of time.
That's right, and that's why the independent counsel was required under 1.8.
That's the question. I mean, that's
and who was the independent counsel and
Mark
who
McCrory.
Gave him advice? And that was advice given to allow the indemnification?
Mark McCrory was the independent counsel. And that's what the March 27 letter specifically says, Defendant's Exhibit Number 72 in the trial record. that they were directed to go to Mark McCrory. Mr. Krug did not want to discuss it with them. So he discharged his duty. And that happens every day. We as lawyers are required to walk these lines of what we can and can't do. And the purpose of having independent counsel is to overcome that and to have the independent lawyer sitting there saying that's a good or that's a bad idea. And I would say ultimately, Justice Bradley, that there was no indemnification of Lyle Krug based on the record before this court.
And that, so why isn't Krug liable if he's not been indemnified?
He shouldn't be responsible. He shouldn't
because?
Be. Because he did not get indemnity. Indemnity would have meant DSI saying to Berner or to Mark McCrory, we've got your lawyer by the hook, pay an additional $200,000. We've got your lawyer by the hook, pay an additional million. We've got your lawyer by the hook, pay something. That never occurred. The only thing we know is that the $1.35 million was to release Berner. There is nothing in this record to say that any of that money went for Lyle Krug. There is nothing in this record that Lyle Krug asked to be put on that release. There is nothing in this record that Lyle Krug pressured the Knievels to add him to that release. That is not in the record. Each of the Knievels were asked, Ed, Cheryl, and Steve, did Lyle Krug advise you on settlement? Their response collectively and unequivocally was no. As of March 31st, 2000, he made it abundantly clear he could not be in that position anymore. That's what Rule 1.8 is there for. He discharged his duty by saying, go to independent counsel.
So your position is he wasn't even an attorney then?
Justice, I believe he was still an attorney, and that's why he was required to send them to somebody else.
Well, but when did he stop being an attorney for Bernard Cheese?
If the record indicates that even after he was sued by the Berner, he continued to represent them.
Is that the norm when you have attorney who's also a defendant in an action? Isn't that fertile territory for problems?
I thought it was unusual, and that's why I raised it to the jury. I mean, I'm the one who brought that out. I thought if these people are saying he's such a bad, disloyal person, how is it that they could be entrusting him on one of the most personal items in any individual's estate, namely their estate? Lyle Krug continued to act as the estate lawyer for their mother's estate. And it was paradoxical to me that they could be accusing him of these things and yet continue to employ him in such a personal matter. Justice, can I address a couple your indemnification versus the settlement issue, because I think it's an important one? In their brief, and what he said to you, Justice Ziegler, and Justice Roggensack, okay. You asked him directly, point out what the bad conduct was. They had an opportunity in hundreds of pages of a record to show what the bad conduct was. They had the opportunity in the appellate court and now before this court to tell you what the bad conduct is. And lo, it appears at page 38 of their brief, these four instances. And I would suggest to you that if you look at these citations and you read the record, that what is set forth here did not occur. When he says that Krug admitted it was a breach of duty of loyalty to pressure Berner to settle the case so that his firm would not have to report that claim against the insurance company, Lyle Krug answered, yes, of course that is. If you're an attorney and you know anything about rules of professional conduct, absolutely. If I try to pressure my client to settle the case so I don't have an issue, That is a breach of duty. That's an easy answer. The question is, did he do it? Did he do it? And that's where the record is naked. In fact, it's not only naked, it's 180 degrees the opposite, because each of the connivals admitted, and I can cite to you in the record exactly where, that Lyle Krug was not giving settlement advice. Cheryl Knievel in the record, at record 216, page 112, page 111. In the record for Steve Knievel, record 214, page 94. In the record, Ed Knievel, record 220, page 94. Lyle Krug, after March 31, 2000, recognized the conflict that existed and told them go to independent counsel. And all the Knievels admitted that fact. I want to keep going on this page 38. They spent hours with Dwayne Hastings, Lyle Krug's partner, about what is bad and about all of his notes, about Hastings' concern and Lyle's concern that this could be a problem with the insurance company, that Lyle could be added as a defendant. Absolutely, those were concerns that they had. But that begs the question. And frankly, it doesn't answer the seminal question. What did they do based on those feelings? Did they use those feelings to pressure these people to settle? I can go back and read to you again the record where the answer is unequivocally no. They had those feelings. They're human beings. Dwayne Hastings, each of those people, the Knievels admitted, after March 3rd, they didn't hear from Dwayne Hastings. Dwayne Hastings wasn't communicating. And that's where we have to be so careful, because Mr. Schultz is saying the lawyers pressured, the lawyers pressured. Well, which lawyers? In the record, where did Lyle Krug pressure after March 27,
00? Well, but maybe the pressure came before that, in that it just continued on. I mean, the lawyer can have a, maybe not in this case, some hard luck story that he explains to the client beforehand relating to insurance, relating to illness in the lawyer's family, and then the lawyer says, but you know, I got to get out because now we have a potential conflict because you want money from me personally on this, so I got to get out, and you should seek independent counsel. Well, that's still a pressure.
I think and that's why the rule exists, Justice, of 1.8, is so that we don't let that pressure affect our independent fidelity to the client.
You're saying as soon as there is independent counsel here, Krug is released from any liability.
And that's the purpose of 1.8. It has to be. Because that's at the point, Your Honor, where his judgment is being affected and clouded, and that's where you have to, as a lawyer, say, I can't do it. Justice, can I also address a question that you had, is when did this occur? The record is abundantly clear that it occurred in March of 2000, March 3rd of 2000.
The it being
when things started to turn a little bit, where the folks were saying, hey, our case, the Berners case, is starting to look bad, and the Steinmans is starting to look good. And if I could dwell on this just for a moment, the record will show that what occurred is during the course of a deposition of a Stephen Fay, some issues came out about who he was employed by. And there was some dispute and muddling about that because he was indeed the national sales manager for Berner. However, he was on DSI's payroll for reasons that I never frankly understood, other than they were trying to avoid Illinois taxes on him. Okay, so at that point there became an issue in the case, and the issue was, will Lyle Krug's file be turned over? Because if the court finds, which it did, that Stephen Fay was not a Berner employee within the control group, and Lyle Krug was having discussions with him, then Lyle Krug, what you're using in those discussions and what you said is no longer protected by the attorney-client privilege. And that's where this defendant's exhibit number 12, which is put Steinman's out of business, comes in. And that's where Mark McCrory says, if this stuff is unleashed in the hands of Lyle Blackburn, the whole theory of DSI against Berner was, and the allegations in each of the complaints were, that DSI was saying Berner was trying to put us out of business. They were trying to eliminate us as a competitor, ironically. I mean, that was an allegation in the complaint filed by DSI against Berner. And lo and behold, there is a note in Lyle Krug's file that Mr. Blackburn had not received and never received, but could have based on this attorney-client privilege issue.
There is so much intrigue in this case. I want to go back to the law.
Okay. Well, that's how it all started.
I know.
Can I go back?
No, I want to ask a question on punitive damages, okay, if I may, and that is the Tucker case. Now, the Tucker case is easy for me to understand because of our comparative negligence rules. If you're over 50%, you're not going to, as a matter of operation of law, even though the jury wrote in a nice fat sum for you in terms of damages, as an operation of law, you're not going to recover one penny of that matter. We have here a different fact situation because we have a 60-40 negligence split,
yes,
but in a 60-40 negligence split, in the ordinary course of events, there would be both an award and recovery in this case. What we have entering into this case, as I see it, is apparently there were payments from third parties, from collateral sources. And there's some kind of an agreement that that limits recovery of the award given, not by operation of law, but by operation of this agreement. How are we going to handle these collateral source payments? So it seems to me that Tucker isn't controlling because what's going on here is a set-off pursuant to an agreement of how to handle third-party payments. Yeah, respond to that. I'm concerned about the Court of Appeals' broad brush of Tucker.
I'm prepared. I can direct you, Justice Bradley, to the Record 218, which is the motion in limine conference. And within that, if you look at defendant's motion in limine number 5, that is where the discussion occurs about this set-off. So in the record, which is in before this court, there is a discussion of a $650,000 payment that came from Berner's CGL policy carrier. And I want to make that point and emphasize that point in that that is not a set-off in the true sense of what we understand to be a collateral source payment. The $650,000, Berner said, we're being sued by DSI. You have an obligation under our CGL policy to defend and indemnify us. So Berner, in essence, was asking its insurance carrier for this suit, you kick in $650,000. The timing of that, Justice Bradley, occurred as this, and it's in the record. In that record 218 and in my motions in limine number 5. That there was a lawsuit pending between Berner and the insurance company in Illinois on the declaratory part, whether or not the insurance company had a duty to defend and indemnify. That case was still, and that's in the settlement agreement between Berner and DSI. That case had not resolved at the time the $1.35 million settlement was achieved. So Berner had in its ability to achieve 100% recovery of the $1.35 it paid from its CGL policy. What it ended up doing was settling with the carrier and had $650,000 of that 1.35 paid.
How does that help you in terms of making the Tucker case applicable?
This is, Justice Crooks, this is exactly how, in two respects. It's ironic. I recognize the dissent in Tucker. And if you look at the pleadings in this case, you'll see that the son of the Chief Justice is actually on the pleadings in this case, in the dissent in Tucker. And I've read through that dissent.
Does that mean we give more or less?
Well, I don't know. I thought it ironic. I mean, this case is full of ironies. And when I saw that, Chief Justice Abrahamson, I mean, you concurred in the dissent, or you not concurred, but were included.
Not the son of this Chief Justice.
All right.
No, exactly.
We should make that clear.
Let right. the record reflect.
Yes. That's very correct.
He's not even in Illinois, let alone in Wisconsin.
Here's how the Tucker case would be applicable. I start with the definition that an award represents a remedy recoverable, and here's the operative word or operative phrase, in accordance with an order for judgment. Tucker stands for the proposition. In order to recover punitive damages, you need an award recoverable in accordance with an order for judgment. The record in this case is that the judgment was zero.
Well, counsel, if I can follow up Justice Bradley's question, because I have the same question with respect to this. As I understand Tucker, and as I understand Wusso, and I'm looking at language on page 449 in Tucker. In the present case, actual damages of the most severe form were sustained. However, there was neither voluntary payment by means of settlement nor a right to receive compensatory damages under section 895.045. That seemed to be the gist. This was, as Justice Bradley indicated in her question, this seems to be a comparative negligence case where if you've got under 50% liability by operation of law, there is no payment. So even though the jury may have held you negligent, you're not, by operation of law, required to pay. That is a very different situation in my, maybe I'm reading this wrong, but as I see this case, where you have liability established above 50% and a right to receive compensatory damages that may have been settled by the set-offs. And I think that was the gist, if I understood Justice Bradley's question.
That's right.
Of what where her question was going. So I'm not sure she got an answer to that.
Here's the answer to that. That's why I said it's not the classic collateral source. It's not a collateral source in this sense. In a legal malpractice case, unlike Wausau and unlike Tucker, you are not suing for personal injuries. The law is very clear on this. In a legal malpractice, you are suing for what we call pecuniary injuries. That is, damages that you have sustained that you're out of pocket. It's a pecuniary versus a personal injury. So in this instance, and based on the record in this case, if Berner sustained no damages, which in fact what has occurred, because they've been compensated by third parties, not collateral source, but indeed their damages have been paid down by sources which they were entitled to recover from, ultimately down to the point where the jury's verdict in this case, $850,000, was a verdict that was by operation of law zero. It had to be because of these other payments. And that's where I think this case is stronger than Tucker. And I'll say this because I agree in Tucker where the dissent had an issue. And they said, wait a minute, you're telling us by simple operation of a statute that cuts off liability, frankly, somewhat arbitrarily, we are going to say that there is no recovery in this case. And that's what the dissent was concerned with, that it was a statutory bar. In this case, we're not talking, Justice Butler, about a statutory bar. We're talking about a rule of law that says in a legal malpractice case, you can only recover pecuniary injuries. Well, there were none. There were none by virtue of these set-offs. And Justice Butler, can I also make one more point on that? If you looked at the jury's verdict here, I'm running out of time. The verdict is interesting.
You are out of time.
Should I sit down?
No, okay. You may finish.
Thank you. The jury's verdict was $850,000. It wasn't $1.35 million.
Well, that was the 40%, isn't that?
No.
Off?
Taking the 40% off, it went down to 425.
Right.
Or, well, my math is bad, but we don't want to get caught up in that. The jury's verdict was $850,000. You look at this verdict, and the jury did not buy the argument that the $1.35 million was damage. I mean, that's the only way we can look at it, because the record's devoid of any evidence that Berner paid more than its share in order to settle for Lyle Krug. So if we look at this verdict, Justice Butler, and we say it's $850,000, well, what were they paying? What was the jury awarding? The only logical conclusion we can reach in this case from this record, it was the attorney's fees that they were seeking. And that's where I say this case is stronger than Tucker, because it's an offset, but in theory, they have not been damaged.
Did they have to do the offset in this case?
Yes. That's why it's absolutely. There can be no cause of action.
Make sure you stay in front of the
microphone. I'm sorry. So nervous. There can be no cause of action in legal malpractice unless you have all those elements, and the last element is damages. If you and I liken it like this, you can have a legal malpractice case. The law in Illinois and Wisconsin is very clear on this, is that a lawyer can mess up. They can blow an appeal, but if that appeal had no merit in the first instance, then there has been no damage. In this case, there has been no damage because that $850,000 had already been reimbursed to the aggrieved party here. I appreciate you admitting me and the opportunity to speak. I'd be happy to stand up here and answer more questions.
May I ask one more?
Mr. Prosser.
Counsel, you referred to your opposing counsel's brief at page 38.
Yes, Justice.
Those 4 points.
At page 38,
yeah.
That's where they list the supposed bad acts that would warrant punitive damages.
That's right. And the brief reads in part, Krug admitted it was a breach of the duty of loyalty to pressure Berner to settle the case. Are you saying that the record will reflect this as a hypothetical question rather than an admission?
That's absolutely correct. Those were hypothetical questions being asked.
Is that true all the way down the line?
The next one is not a hypothetical. It's again, it's something that Hastings admitted, that Berner had no duty to indemnify Krug. I mean, that's something that Hastings simply admitted he didn't believe legally, and that he told Krug, that's a true. But he didn't tell that to Berner even after he learned that Krug had sought indemnification. That's where I take issue, is that by virtue of that March 27, 2000 letter, and Krug's advice to them, of course, that would be the proverbial fox watching the hen house. Hastings had no duty to tell them. Independent counsel did. Any advice given by Hastings under this scenario would have been automatically, by operation of 1.8, bad advice. So the next question is, did you have a duty to tell them? The answer is no. That was McCrory. I could keep going. I feel as though I'm...
Okay. Thank you.
Next one?
No.
Okay.
I will ask Mr. Schultz, what's your rebuttal to what he has just said on that point?
Justices.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Schultz.
Justice. And let me start, Justice Prosser, by saying that in our view, we have very accurately cited the record. These were not hypotheticals. These were this is what happened, and they were asked, Mr. Hastings, Mr. Krug, respectively, was it proper for you to do this? And they admitted at trial in front of the jury that it was not proper for them to do these things that they did. And in our view, the record cites fully support the statements that we make on page 38 of the brief.
Counsel, do you agree with opposing counsel that Berner had no out-of-pocket losses due to legal malpractice? And I'm including now the payment that was made from the insurance company. So at that time and the settlements from others, do you agree that they had no out-of-pocket loss due to malpractice?
No, absolutely not. That they did have it. It's more tricky than it needs to be. If we had sued everybody in one case, it might well have been a situation where we settled with one defendant and then they were out of the case, and we settled with another defendant and they were out of the case. And as you, I think it was Justice Rogensack, pointed out earlier, we can't recover twice. So there's no question that to the extent we recover some of our damages from one defendant, we can't then recover the same damages from another defendant later in the case. Okay. But there is no question that the total of what we recovered from other defendants was in the vicinity, and I don't have the exact number today, of around $1 million or $1.1 million. And so since Berner's total damages proved at trial were about $2.5 million, there is no question that there was still damage.
Let me start again, because I'm sorry, in the middle, which is kind of where I am in the problem here instead of at the beginning. Okay. The damages proved at trial were reduced by 40% because Berner was 40% negligent, correct?
The damages the jury found. The damages the jury assessed.
The only damages that I can deal with,
because
I don't find facts. Okay,
right.
So those are the damages as far as I'm concerned. Okay, so those, and we're just looking at malpractice now. I understand your other argument on breach of fiduciary duty. So you got them reduced by 40%. Now, with that 40% that's reduced, so you got 60% left, that's their out-of-pocket, according to the jury, on the malpractice, correct?
That's what the jury found.
With this amount that's out-of-pocket, after they receive settlement, were they out of pocket anything?
I'm not quite sure I'm understanding.
Okay, what I'm saying is, given the 60% the jury said that they could collect of the damages for legal malpractice, when Berner got settlement from whoever, and I don't care, were they out of pocket any money due to legal malpractice?
If I understand your question, the answer would be no, because the 60% of 850 was less than what they had already received from, and what we had agreed would.
Okay, so then you agree with opposing counsel that after they got the settlement, they were not out of pocket for, they had no out of pocket damages for legal malpractice.
At least with respect to Mr. Krug, that yes, that's true.
Okay, all right. I just wanted to be sure I got the facts clear. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Tell me how that is operative with regard to the issue of punitive damages.
Well, I think that it's operative because I read Tucker the same way that you do, and I think that Justice Butler does, that Tucker simply says if the plaintiff's damages or the plaintiff's negligence is more than 50%, then by law the plaintiff cannot be awarded any compensatory damages, and therefore there can be no punitive damages. But here that was not the case. The plaintiff could have been, and in fact was, awarded compensatory damages that they could have recovered. They only did not recover that amount because of settlements they had previously received from other defendants.
I think my question was inartfully stated. Okay. So let me try it a different way. Is the determination, let's say they were great, they did a great job in getting settlements from third parties, you know. I mean, they really, you know.
They had better lawyers than they did.
They had great lawyers and, got, you know. Should the level of success in getting settlements from third parties affect
in the normal case where there isn't some kind of side agreement, affect whether or not they are entitled to punitive damages vis-a-vis out-of-pocket expenses? I mean, I just don't know where that comes into
equation. In our view, the matter is relatively simple. As long as the jury awards compensatory damages against this defendant, as in fact they did, you should be entitled to have the jury also award punitive damages. There is, of course, the case that I think it's the Jacques case, if I'm not mistaken, if there's no compensatory damages at all, if the plaintiff has not been damaged, then you cannot recover punitive damages. But if the plaintiff has been damaged and has been awarded compensatory damages, the fact that those damages are not paid, if, for example, the defendant had gone bankrupt and his insurance company had gone bankrupt so that those damages were never ultimately paid.
Never recovered.
That shouldn't affect their entitlement to punitive damages.
But, Counselor, here you just agreed that they don't have any damages that result from legal malpractice because they got paid for all their damages by somebody else,
well,
right?
Well, maybe I was inarticulate this time. They did have damages. They had just already been paid for those damages by other defendants, and so they couldn't collect again from Mr. Krug. But they had certainly been damaged by the legal malpractice. They had just already been paid by other defendants.
Okay.
Maybe I was inarticulate that time.
Probably me.
All right, I see that I am out of time.
You are, counsel.
Thank you very much.
I want to thank both Mr. Schultz and Mr. Konasik for their arguments this morning, and we close our hearing on 05 AP 1527, Berner Cheese Corporation versus Lyle Krug. The court will take a few moments in recess to enable these students and others to leave, and I think we have a new group of students coming in. Thank you. We are in recess.